Amanda Palmer has built a uniquely interesting and impressive career, artistically and financially, by showing all of herself and by committing to a fan base. Her book, The Art of Asking, details how she raised over $1 million for her album on Kickstarter and how she's built a passionate and loyal audience over time. I've been curious about what the asker owes the giver in return and what happens when you ask for too much, and if people who have audiences feel like they'd prefer to have more privacy. We talk about all this. We also talk about Amanda's best friend who just passed, and about how becoming a mother is going to affect her life. It's a heavy interview. Here's Amanda.
The Art of Asking, for those who haven't yet gotten to read it, what did you want them to walk away with?
Oh, you know, someone tweeted me this morning that they read the book and felt changed. And I think that's probably all any author could wish from a book, is that someone's actually moved or changed by the things that you've written. And, you know, the few years leading up to the writing of that book were really rough for me. I went through a lot of, you know, I went through a lot of internet controversy. I went through, you know, a best friend getting cancer. I went through, you know, sort of all the trials and tribulations of Kickstarter and the ensuing madness. And you know, despite going through all of that shit, I really was kind of forced to hammer out my personal philosophy of why certain things work in you know, when it comes to running art and a business, and what feels good and what doesn't. And you know, I took a lot of that into my TED talk, but the TED talk was so short that I found myself, you know, really wanting to expand on all of the ideas, because I kept making all of these connections in my head between the, you know, the strange connections, but the really obvious ones between the Kickstarter and me and my fans and my marriage and my relationships and how we trust each other and how we don't and how we make decisions and how we don't. And so, you know, if I figured if people could read the book and maybe reframe the idea of help and asking and vulnerability and, you know, reliance and self-reliance, and if it changed even just a little bit of perspective, then I will have done my job as an author.
Mm-hmm. And you released that, you know, almost a year ago. And a lot's happened since, and a lot's happened, you know, recently. You know, you have a baby on the long way. You have, you know, the best friend that you mentioned passed recently. You know, what's it been like since writing the book?
Well, you know, the funny thing about writing a book when you're a songwriter and like me, you know, and you tour around, is usually the way it works is you make the piece of art in private, and then you go out and you constantly share it on stage and get, you know, and get it and get a live reaction to what it is that you've created. And a book is very different. You know, a book you create in private, and then all of these people go off and have their own private relationship with the book. It's about as far from a public performance as you can get. And so it's been really interesting for me to watch the slow burn of the book and the effect it's had on people. And, you know, the wonderful thing about digital media is, you know, when I check in on Twitter every day, there's always someone, you know, once an hour saying, "I've just finished reading the book. Thank you so much. This is what I took from it. I can't wait to share it with my sister," or whatever. And that just reminds me that, you know, the book didn't just get written and then fall into a vacuum, that, you know, it's sort of got this long, subtle half-life, which is very different from the work that I usually do, where I'm usually there when people are experiencing it.
What's not in the book, and if everything is in the book, how would you change, you know, if you were writing that book right now after everything that's happened, how would it be different?
Oh man, I mean, that's such an impossible question to answer because, I think it was Picasso or one of those great painters who said no painting is ever finished. You just stop at some point. And I felt that way about the book. I mean, since my life did not cease to exist as I was writing the book, and it was a memoir about the moment. It was a memoir about Anthony being sick. It was a memoir about my internet controversies. It was a memoir about my marriage. And as I was writing the book, all of that shit kept happening. It's not like life stopped so that I could sit and reflect on it. And, at a certain point, I realized, as I was editing the book, I was walking down the street and running into fans who were telling me these incredible stories. And every day I would be like, oh my God, I have to put that in my book. It's so perfect. It all fits. Oh my God, it's all. And, at a certain point, you realize that's never gonna stop happening. And so, I had to, at a certain point, I had to just say, this is the photograph of the moment. I could keep adding to it forever. But, if I were writing that book this year, there would probably be a lot of reflections about, birth and death, and, the Anthony story wouldn't leave you hanging. At the end of the book, my best friend would be dead instead of in a state of cancer remission. And I would be, and I would be, I would be on the road to having a child, and it would just, it would just be the ever continuing saga of an artist's life. But the book was what it was, and I also, got to remember, I wrote it really quickly. I wrote the bulk of the book in 6 weeks. And I really do think, as a writer, as a songwriter, as a poet, I do my best work, especially because I feel like I'm always trying to take an emotional snapshot of one moment. I do my best work when I just sit myself down, strap myself to a chair, and purge everything all at once. And that's sort of the approach that I took to the book. And I think it worked, but it also meant that, I had to commit to that moment. I couldn't just keep piling on.
I don't know if this is the best way to phrase it, but there seems to be not, it seems to be like as a society, we don't really know how to process death very, very well. And for,
No, we're terrible. We're
yeah.
really terrible at it.
And for listeners and fans, everyone loses the people that are the closest to them. How do you like, how do people deal with, how should people deal with it? Like how, what do you, I mean, now that you're going through this, what do you think about it?
Well, I've had a lot of people die in my life. I lost my brother when I was 21, and that same year I lost both of my grandparents and a recent boyfriend. They all went within 10 months of each other. And I've had various friends and boyfriends and now my best friend. And I always look to my basic mindfulness practice, which is, a lot of what Anthony taught me, who was, he's one of the main characters in The Art of Asking, and my friend who just died. And from the time I was a teenager, he introduced me to yoga and meditation and Buddhism. And the basic fundamental idea that death is just part of life. And that our mortality is something that we grapple with from day one until it's over. But living your life in fear is a waste, it's a waste of life. And I never felt it more than when he was leaving, that it was sort of like the ultimate final exam for everything he taught me as my mentor, to not be attached and to let him go, and to know that, I am living in this moment and this moment and this moment, and he may be here and he may be gone, but you know, if anything else, it's continued to hammer into me this sense of, you know, of no regrets, which is kind of the philosophy that I've taken in my career and in my life, which is, you know, you can spend your life looking backwards and regretting that you didn't turn left or right at any given fork in the road, or you can just look around and appreciate where you are in the present, you know, with all of its slings and arrows and the heartbreaks and the pain and the suffering, and just accept that this is the deal. And death is a part of that, you know, and death is a part of it, and sickness is a part of it, and having babies is a part of it, and, you know, forgiving yourself is a part of it. And it, you know, to me, it's been a really interesting grieving him in particular, because this is the guy who spent his life, you know, for the last 30 years training me to not be attached. And I feel like I would be dishonoring his memory if I just sort of sat around and stewed about my best friend being gone. Yeah, I feel like the best thing I can do is, like, you know, go out dancing and eat ice cream and pat my pregnant belly and go, like, that was then and this is now, and these two moments are different and I have to appreciate them both.
I ask, and I'm interested, you know, I'm self-interestedly asking these questions because I lost someone similarly very close to me a few years ago and haven't been really able to process it, and so kind of just didn't. But it flashes up in all sorts of other ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also a lot of it is just knowing that, you know, your psyche, your emotions, you know, you've got some kind of internal wisdom. And I've got to say, being pregnant and grieving a death right at the same time is a really interesting combination, because both of them, at their base fundamental level, are about really just letting go of the ridiculous notion that you have control. I mean, you just don't have control. Someone dies, and you can have all the ideas you want about how it should be, and how sad you should be, and how, you know, and how long it should take, and whatever. And the truth is, you just have no control. The best thing you can do is step back and say, this is going to be what it's going to be. You know, it's going to take what it's going to take. And honestly, like with everything else, like with falling in love, like with falling out of love, like any other huge human transition and trauma, you kind of have to just step back and let it happen. And that can be really hard. You know, we desperately want to have control over these things. We desperately want to steer our emotions in a way that's convenient. And, you know, it's such a joke. I mean, we don't have, but, you know, that can also be really liberating when you're constantly reminding yourself that, you know, ultimately, at the end of the day, all you can do is be kind to yourself, do what you can, and get out of your own way.
You know, it's interesting because my sister also is pregnant and about to give birth soon, and I've heard that you know, the best way for you to realize that life is not all about you is to have a kid.
Yeah,
And that's
people
scary.
have told me that for years.
As someone who, you know, whose living is so much entwined with your relationship to an audience, and you know, and releasing, unearthing your, you know, your soul through your art to the audience, how do you think about, you know, having kin, how that's gonna change your life?
to tell you the honest truth, I deal with it by not thinking about it. I mean, I really do. It's a lot like the grief thing, because there are so many people with so many ideas and so many things to say. And at the end of the day, what I really want is to have the experience. And I know that I can't think my way into the experience. I know I just have to have it. And so a lot of what I've been doing in my life lately isn't moving towards something. It's just clearing space because I have no idea what the fuck is about to happen to me. And I know I don't know. And so the best I can do is like make sure that I'm not distracted, make sure that I'm paying attention, you know, make sure that I am as basically as clear and as healthy as possible, because I feel like I'm about to get hit by a freight train and I really want to know what it's going to feel. I really want to know what it's going to feel like. I don't want to be asleep for this experience, because I know whatever happens, it's going to be totally surreal. And if I have any ideas about it, like, that's laughable. I can just forget about it. If I have any expectations, forget that too. There's no way it's going to match up to anything I can imagine. And it also, it's, you know, it takes a certain amount of faith. I mean, I'm 39. I've lived this very full and crazy and very independent life, you know, running around for the last 15 years as an artist, constantly traveling, constantly doing strange things, constantly improvising and, you know, steering my own destiny from one continent to the other. And I really have had to believe, like, in a way that other people believe in Jesus or in Allah, like, I have had to believe something that I cannot see. I have had to believe all these women who've come before me and all of these artists when they assure me that my life is not going to get swallowed and steamrollered and destroyed by the act of having a child. You know, because that's, you know, that of course is like my deepest, darkest fear, is that I'm going to pop this kid out and that's going to be the end of my independent life, and that's going to be the end of having fun forever, and that's going to be the end of being able to jet around impulsively. And, you know, I think at a certain point, yes, it is going to be the end of one particular era, but I have had to put this like mountain of faith into all of the women who, you know, who I've sort of like, you know, Spanish inquisitioned over the past few years as I've been considering whether or not to have a kid, that my life will go on, and I'm going to have to metamorphosize into something else. And so, you know, that's been hard for me. I'm, you know, as an artist and as a person, I'm a kind of a control freak, and this one is a big test.
Yeah. And you only have so much control over how your kid is. The kid could.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no control really. You get what you get.
And yeah. And it's, you know, I live somewhat of a nomadic life as well, and a bit younger, but there are often people would tell me, oh, that's fun for a bit, but eventually you want to settle down and kind of commit to things beyond yourself. And they typically allude to a family. And I'm curious if they're just kind of reaffirming their own decisions, or if that is indeed what happens.
You know, who fucking knows, honestly? Yeah. I mean, really, you don't know. And I mean, I also think pregnant women are a Rorschach for everybody around you. I mean, I have had people, you know, from the entire spectrum of folks who have had kids, because of course, being who I am and doing what I do, I encounter hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who are very open with me. And, you know, and I get everything from people clutching me and saying, your life is about to begin. You have no idea what love is until you have a child. I'm so excited for you. You're about to go on this spectacular adventure and you can do whatever you want, you know, with this like boundless enthusiasm. And on the other hand, I've had people look at me and go like, well, enjoy the next few months because your life's about to end. And it's clearly such a reflection of who they are and what their experience of parenting has been. And if anything else, it inspires and reminds me that there is not one way, and that I'm, you know, and that I am still in control of my own destiny. And if I want this kid to crush me, it probably will. And if I want to just take the kid along for the ride, I probably will.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? We were talking about your Kickstarter, you know, one of the most, I think the most successful Kickstarter of all time, and you, or music Kickstarter, and you, you make art, but your art is also very successful, and you make an art out of making your art successful. you know, it's kind of like a meta performance art on the production of the art.
Yeah, I mean, I think artists have been doing that since the beginning of time, though. There's the art of art, and then there's the art of business, and it's a very blurry line between the two.
You seem to be pretty good at it, or pretty good at distributing it, though.
Or I'm pretty good at giving you the illusion that I'm good at it.
That's funny. I mean, you know, with the Kickstarter, and then, you know, switching over to Patreon, you know, crowdfunding has been huge for you. And of course, the art of asking, that's, you know, it's about what, where do you see kind of the future of crowdfunding and going? And what do you think about donor fatigue? And how have you thought about it going forward in your career and in, you know, sharing your art?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, Kickstarter was very, very fresh and new on a lot of people's radars when I used it and had my huge Kickstarter. You know, that being said, I think if I were just taking the plunge today, my Kickstarter would probably be just as successful. And I think that that's more a reflection of my fan base than it is of the general donor fatigue climate. You know, because a lot of what people don't seem to understand about crowdfunding is that there's just nothing magic about it. It's a tool to harness what was always already there to begin with. And it's a really handy tool, but, you know, nothing confuses me more than people coming to me and saying, well, you know, you think Kickstarter is so great, but I launched one and, you know, and it's only earned $5 out of the 5,000 that I wanted. And so therefore crowdfunding doesn't work. And I look at them saying like, but you didn't have a fan base. So who did you think was going to magically give you the $5,000 that you wanted? Like as if, you know, as if crowdfunding in itself is sort of some magic provider of energy and connection. And it really isn't, you know, if it's a telephone, there has to be someone at the other end of the line picking up the call. And so, you know, what I've seen with Kickstarter is that it's really good for, you know, artists who are already really engaged with their communities and have a really specific vision for a single project, whether it's an album or a film or, you know, something very, very focused and narrow that they want to do that has a beginning and an end. And, you know, what Kickstarter isn't necessarily good for, as I've come to believe, is, you know, artists who just need to constantly create output and need constant support because they're never going to go back to a label. And they, you know, they basically want a salary to put out an album every couple of years and to, you know, and to basically, you know, ask their fans to provide them with their bread and butter. Kickstarter is sort of more of a pain in the ass because you have to constantly go back to the same group of people and say, hey, it's me again. I need to do this again. Can you give me $10 again? Which is why I'll continue to use Kickstarter anytime I have one big, unique, specific project. But when it comes to just putting out music and putting out albums, I've moved my business over to Patreon because I don't have to re-bother everybody every time I need help, because I'm never going to stop needing help, if you know what I mean. I think it all makes so much sense to me on this side of it because I spend my days and nights thinking about how artists and audiences connect. And, you know, I think artists are so specific and audiences are so specific and the way people feel about connection and help is so personal that, you know, I get sad when people think that I have some kind of universal answer, because I definitely don't. You know, I have figured out my own way of doing things with this weird community that I've spent the last 15 years creating, but that doesn't mean it's the right answer for Taylor Swift or for Trent Reznor or for any other artist for that matter. You know, and I think in the, you know, the current climate of, you know, everything from musicians to writers to painters and everyone going, you know, how am I going to make a living in this artistic climate right now? And should I be using crowdfunding and should I be using digital? If there's one giant answer, the only answer that I've taken away in the last few years is that you've got to allow that every single artist is going to do something slightly different and that that has to be acceptable, you know, because what I see out in the press right now, whether it's journalists or novelists or musicians, everyone's just kind of criticizing each other's techniques. And I think that that's a huge waste of breath. I think everyone should just be like, listen, you know, if you want to go the Stephen King path, like, go for it. If you want to go find a publisher, go for it. If you want to put your stuff up on the internet for free, go for it. Like, everything, really everything should be allowed. I think it's our human small-mindedness that believes that there is going to be one path and we're all going to get on it.
Yeah, if there are no giant answers, I want to almost ask the reverse. When you talk to younger artists, are there, you know, huge misconceptions that you see them having, or big don'ts that you advise them, or just in general, what do you tell young artists or makers, or you know, people who want to build communities and audiences?
Well, it's so dependent on what, first of all, what kind of art you make and, you know, what your medium is. And it also really depends on what kind of lifestyle you want. You know, when it comes to musicians, there's so many ways of making a living as a musician, but it's so dependent on what you want to do. And, you know, and it's so dependent on your expectations. So if a 23-year-old, if a really talented 23-year-old songwriter came to me and said, Amanda, help me, I would be like, well, what do you know, what is it that you really want? Do you want to be on stage every night playing for, you know, an increasing number of people and live your life on the road, you know, basically being a journeyman and a troubadour? Then I would give you this set of instructions. If what you really want is to, you know, be making music in the studio and you can't stand live shows and you can't stand audiences, you're going to have a totally different path. And if what you really want is to just like cash in on your talent and hope that if you just like make enough of the right moves, you're going to be the Lady Gaga of the future and you know, what you really want is to be a famous millionaire. I would just basically be like, good luck. You're probably in this for the wrong reason. You know, the chances of that happening, even if you're really hardworking, are a million for one, you know, a million and one. And, you know, and then you've also got the bitter pill to swallow of it's probably not going to make you happy either. So like, good luck on your path towards suffering.
What did you want, and how did you think about it?
Oh, you know, I desperately wanted to be with a crowd of people that I loved. I mean, if I had to take it down to like the basic DNA of, you know, little 22-year-old Amanda Palmer looking at the vast horizon of, you know, of choices and opportunities and all the things I could have chosen. You know, what I really wanted was the deepest connection possible with a group of people around me. You know, I mean, when I was 22, I was like, you know, I was fantasizing about starting an art commune in Boston and, you know, like the thing that really like blew my dress up was like passing by empty real estate and going like, someday I'm going to fill that up with artists and I'm going to have friends all around me and everyone's going to be drinking wine until 5 in the morning, talking about philosophy and running around naked. Like that, you know, and to me at 22, the obvious path to a lifestyle like that was, you know, commit to being an artist and a musician. And put yourself out in the world playing live shows and creating your tribe. You know, and it was certainly never about becoming famous or becoming rich. And, you know, if those two things held any appeal, they only held any appeal insofar as they could get me to that bohemian paradise. And you know, and on that score, I think I've actually succeeded. I mean, I'm really very, very happy with the artists that I work with and the people around me. And I've, and I feel like I've learned the lesson very deeply myself, and also by watching others around me, that, you know, multiplying degrees of fame and success and money don't really multiply your degree of happiness once you get to a certain point in, you know, in music and art. And it can be just as satisfying playing for a room of 50 people as it can for a room of 5,000 people.
Is there a big difference in, so you say it doesn't make you that much happier, but when size increases drastically, is there something that's lost? You know, you're both in small communities and in big communities because you have a big fan base. What do you think about that?
You know, I think it's apples and oranges. You know, there's something thrilling about playing for 5,000 people and, you know, and feeling like you have this massive group of humanity all on the same emotional page, maybe just for 5 minutes. But there is an intimacy that's always lost. And, you know, the metaphors for that are endless, but I think, you know, having a smattering of both in your life is probably healthy. The same way, you know, if all you do, you know, is go out to restaurants and socialize with your one single partner and you never hang out with anyone else, you know, life gets pretty myopic. But, you know, if all you're doing is going out and hanging out in giant groups of people and partying and never actually creating intimate bonds with single people, you're missing out on the good stuff. So, you know, having a nice balance of, you know, intimate artistic moments and giant tribal ones is at least for me really, really necessary. And it's why as I tour, I continue, you know, even if it's not financially wise, I still love continuing to do house parties like the one I write about in the book, where, you know, I could choose to spend that night in front of thousands of people and probably making more money. But there's something really satisfying about stripping things back, getting into a living room with a bunch of human beings, actually talking to them, actually, you know, letting a night unfold and sharing food and wine and private jokes. And that's a totally different experience that you cannot stack up against being in a stadium and, you know, and being really separated by being on stage. I mean, and you get that adrenaline of, like, you know, being the gigantic leader, but, you know, then it's a very much like us and them situation. And I, you know, there's Prince famously does this. When Prince goes on tour, he, you know, he'll play the like local Enormo Dome to 10,000 people. And then he'll like hit a secret club at the end of the night and continue playing for 300 people just to get his rocks off. And I really understand that and can understand how it can be really lonifying being on that stage in front of so many people night after night.
You know, it's fascinating. Well, first off, I'm going to have to Google lonifying to know what that means. But second,
I just made it up. Lonify.
Yeah.
Lonify is like the opposite of Spotify. It's like you download this app to your phone and you press it and nothing happens.
That's amazing.
And it costs you, it's a really masochistic app. It costs you $50 a month just to have it on your phone so you can press it and nothing will happen.
We're going to have to launch that on Product Hunt soon. You know, I mean, it's fascinating. We talk about, you know, private and public and this balance, but your range is so kind of remarkable in that, you know, you do a lot of these solitary activities, you know, yoga, meditate, you make all this art, and then you also live so much in public. And one thing I fear as our company gets bigger and we become more kind of in public is that once you become public, can you really go back? And are you like now responsible for an audience? And I guess, do you ever wish that sometimes you were more private or that you didn't owe someone something, so to speak? Or,
you know, that's such a good question, because I got, I, it, that, that's a, that sort of refrain that I was getting from every journalist I talked to when around the time that I was launching my Kickstarter, which was, you know, all of these people would ask me, Amanda, aren't you scared that you will now owe yourself to your fans and that they're going to have, you know, that they're going to be the boss of you and that all of a sudden you're going to have to answer for this or that or the other thing. And I, you know, that had honestly never occurred to me because having built the relationship that I had built with the kind of trust that I had with my fan base, it just doesn't work that way, you know, and I would have been flabbergasted and shocked if I had made that Kickstarter record and my fan base had turned around and said, but Amanda, this isn't the record that we wanted. Because that's not the relationship. They weren't paying me, you know, for lack of a better word, they weren't paying me for a product. They were paying me as an artist to create whatever it was that I was going to create. And that's an essential part of the relationship, which is that they trusted me. And I trusted them not to judge me when they finally got the album at the end of the day. And they didn't. Of the 25,000 people who supported my Kickstarter, not a single one of them wrote me a nasty email saying this wasn't the album that I fucking wanted. I want my money back. Because everybody knew that's not the game here. The point here is, like, you trust the artist Amanda Palmer with your $20 and you're going to get what you're going to get. And if you don't like it, like, that's a bummer. But it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of like you can't take your CD back to Walmart either and say, this is not the Britney Spears album I was expecting. Like, once you commit to the artist, that's part of that's the beautiful part of the relationship is that trust.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're talking to a younger artist who also has that same fear of putting everything out in public, and, you know, recently with kind of Meerkat and Periscope, when I'm on it, I feel that I become a little bit performative and I'm like, oh, wait, I don't want, you know, I just want to be myself. How do you feel that being in public makes you a better person? Does it make you a worse person sometimes? How do you check yourself when you're always being watched, so to speak?
Well, I think you just have to be very meta about it and
make sure the ego doesn't get in the way.
Well, I think my key to that is to always be very transparent whenever possible with myself and with my fans so that, you know, I try to call myself on my own narcissism. And when I feel like I am getting obsessed with my own image, I just sort of blurt it out and say it. And therefore, like, you know, I sort of embrace the flaws as I go along. And, you know, and when I start to frighten myself because I feel like I'm getting too obsessed with my own career or too obsessed with my own statistics or, you know, whatever, I can sense it. And when those fears start to seep in, that's just when I step back and I write a blog about it. And, you know, and it's the act of sharing those weird, conflicted emotions, which, by the way, everybody has, because every time you raise your hand and say, like, isn't it weird that we're all, like, when we're doing Skype videos, we're all just looking at ourselves. At any time you say that and you look around the room, you just see a room of nodding heads going like, I'm glad someone said it, you know, and that's what keeps us connected. You know, the idea is not to be flawless. It's not to be perfect. It's not to, like, you know, finally master the art of social media. There's no such thing. All you can do is, like, play around with all these tools, be your own self-anthropologist, and then toss these ideas back out into the universe going like, huh, isn't this strange? Isn't this a little weird? Oh, look, I'm obsessed with myself today. Like, you know, and it's that level of honesty, you know, and challenging yourself to be truly honest, even when you think it makes you look bad or look egotistical or look ugly, you still throw it out there because that's what keeps people actually intimate and close with you. If everything is manicured and you're not being honest about it, that's when you actually really veer into the dark. And that is the, you know, that is the place that I've constantly been trying to avoid. And those who have been following me and following my blog and following me on Twitter for years, they know this side of me. They know the, you know, the really self-deprecating, really self-doubting, really transparent side of me, which is what can make it difficult when some stranger comes in from the outside, takes a flashing, you know, takes a flash glance at me and just sees this, you know, this like crazed, you know, narcissistic, self-obsessed artist. I'm like, well, yeah, I kind of am. But I'm also constantly picking myself apart and trying to figure out what it is that makes me tick and try to figure out what it is that makes me, you know, whatever I am. And I'm doing it in collaboration with all these people so that none of us feel lonely. And that's sort of that's the side of myself that I think most of the critics who were, you know, always screaming at me way from, you know, from way out in the left field don't see, because you can't really see that side of me unless you're kind of hanging out in my yard.
Yeah. And I think that's what a lot of people, you know, among the other things, that's what people get from your art and the way you conduct yourself is they feel less alone.
Which is really, like, I mean, in my opinion, the highest achievement of any kind of art.
I agree.
Any genre, any medium, any music, any painting, any novel, any film, if a piece of art can make you feel less alone, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's high art or low art or middle art, or, you know, it really doesn't matter. That's why we human beings came up with art in the first place, I think.
That is, and that's the whole goal of this podcast. So Amanda, thank you for taking the time. I know you got to run, so I want to respect your time. The book is Art of Asking. We will be featuring it on Product Hunt. And yeah, Amanda, really appreciate you taking the time. Chat with us.
Yeah, no problem. It was a great, great chat. And tell your sister, mazel tov on her baby and good luck with her birth. I hope that she's in labor for like 5 minutes.
Will do. She's a listener. She will appreciate that. And I'll tell her as well. Any last plugs of anything upcoming for you or where people can find you online?
Well, I would love to point people towards my Patreon, which is sort of my next generation Kickstarter and sort of where I have been gathering my whole crowd. And my blogs are emailed out there, and you can support me for as little as a dollar and sort of become a part of my Patreon community. And it's been lots of fun. And I'm doing some very weird projects this summer, funded and supported by all of those Patreon people. There's about 5,000 people on there right now, and it's been a blast. So if you just Google Patreon Amanda Palmer, you'll find it, or you can go to my website and find it there. And I would also remind people there's an audiobook of The Art of Asking 2, which is great, and I recorded myself. And that a lot of my music, if you're unfamiliar with my actual music and songs, in the book itself, there's a little page to a link called Amandalanda that I put up for readers of the book who, you know, basically get a playlist and an idea of what kind of music I've been making for the past 15 years. So you can find that in the book, or maybe you can stick it up on your website, which is basically just like a primer for Dresden Dolls and Amanda Palmer music.
Perfect. Absolutely will do. Thanks, Amanda.